The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to send in some comments, comment on the broadcast, you can send those emails to td@kpcg.fm. Well, here we are broadcasting on the last day of August already. Where did this month go? And looking at some of the stats for the month, SoundCloud in particular, unless we really finish strong today, looks like we're going to finish just short of 30,000 plays for the month. Last month, you'll recall, some of you, that I think we, in setting that new record, it was somewhere up around 32,000, 32,500. This month, it looks like it'll be just under 30,000, so still a pretty strong month compared to what we were pulling in at the start of this year, this calendar year. But yet, some work to be done. And as we head into the Roman calendar month of September, we'll be looking to bump those numbers up in the right direction. I want to begin today's program with something that Secretary of State John Kerry said in Bangladesh on Monday. This made the rounds on some of the conservative blogs and news sites yesterday. But he said there about terrorism, that it's easy to terrorize and that no country is going to be immune from it. He says the government has to be right all the time. They've got to be correct in fighting against terrorism. They've got to be correct 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. But if one person decides to be a terrorist and he's willing to kill himself, well, he can go out and kill people in this world. He can go out, as Mr. Kerry said, and make some noise. And then this. He said, quote, perhaps the media would do us all a service if they didn't cover it quite as much. People wouldn't know what's going on. And then according to the State Department's transcript, there was applause after that statement about the media, how that it shouldn't cover these terrorist attacks as much as it has been, and that if they didn't cover it as much, people, this is a direct quote, people wouldn't know what's going on. Earlier this year, I read George Orwell's 1984, and you read through that book and just think, boy, this is just, I mean, this is just crazy. I think Orwell wrote that back in the 30s or 40s, I forget the date, but here he was talking about this mother government basically erasing history or changing the story, revising it as they went, and it just seemed so preposterous. And I read through it thinking, well, how could so many people just believe in so many lies, a web of lies? And yet, look at this world today. Look at how many things in today's world are not what they seem to be. You look at the spirit of deception and dishonesty. Look at the lies. I mean, that spirit is so strong. People don't know what to believe. People have been duped. They've been lied to. Today we're going to look at the spirit that's behind this lying and this hypocrisy, this duplicity. It's actually prophesied in your Bible. Going back to what Secretary Kerry had to say on Monday, I mean, he was just echoing his boss, President Obama, who's made statements before, talking about how the press should downplay some of these terrorist attacks. This first clip I'll play for you, clip one, it's from something the president said in November of last year.
The message I have is that those of us who are charged with protecting the American people are going to do everything we can to destroy this particular network. Once this network is destroyed, and it will be, there may be others that pop up in different parts of the world. And so we're going to have to continue to take seriously how we maintain the infrastructure that we built to prevent this. But it doesn't have to change the fundamental trajectory of the American people. And that we should feel confident about. And the media needs to help in this. I mean, I just want to say, during the course of this week, a very difficult week, it is understandable that this has been a primary focus. But one of the things that has to happen is how we report on this has to maintain perspective and not empower in any way these terrorist organizations or elevate them in ways that make it easier for them to recruit or make them stronger.
So he said that back in November. Of course, you had the November attack in Paris. And he's talking about our defense against these attacks and how the media needs to help in this. And how can the media help? Well, by making sure that they give it perspective, that they maintain perspective, and not report on it in a way or too much so that it gives encouragement or hope to these terrorist organizations and makes it easier for them to attract more followers. And so there's a narrative that President Obama and that John Kerry and all the fiction writers at the White House are working hard. They're working hard to create. They want the story told in just a certain way. Going back to what Kerry said, the media would do us all a service if it didn't cover quite as much as it does. People then wouldn't know what's going on. Well, we're in the midst of a campaign season as well, and of course, as is always the case, you have politicians who are out there, and I know we've gone through some of this before. It does seem to be a reoccurring theme on this program. It seems every few weeks you have to get into this spirit of lies. But as I think you'll see later on in the show, with as much as God has to say about it, even in latter-day prophecies for the latter day, well, and when you see what he thinks about it, it is something that we need to go through often. I think it was early July when we did the program following the FBI's investigation into Hillary Clinton's email servers and such. And you might remember James Comey came out with this long statement. And just methodically, he said they weren't going to press charges or they weren't going to recommend that that she be tried. But he did nevertheless methodically go through point by point all of these areas and ways and with all of these statements that Secretary Clinton has made that were dishonest. This is how the New York Times reported on that investigation. It says, Mr. Comey rebuked Mrs. Clinton as being extremely careless in using a private email address and server. He raised questions about her judgment, contradicted statements she has made about her email practices, said it was possible that hostile foreign governments had gained access to her account, and declared that a person still employed by the government, Mrs. Clinton left the State Department in 2013, could have faced disciplinary action for doing what she did. And then at the end, of course, he said or recommended that the Justice Department not go forward in any event. I mean, that's from the New York Times. That's the New York Times assessment. Now, let me quote for you what Victor Davis Hanson wrote yesterday. This is in his latest column about why Hillary Clinton is never held accountable for her lies. And with respect to this, this story on the servers, Hanson says here, almost everything Hillary Clinton has said about her current scandals is a lie. No other Secretary of State used a personal server. Colin Powell was certainly not her model for lawbreaking. She really did send and receive classified materials that she at the time knew were classified. Comey went through that over and again. At the time, she did not have lawyers examine all of her personal emails that she destroyed. They were not mostly about Chelsea and yoga. She did not accurately inform authorities of the actual number of her personal emails. There was no firewall between the State Department and the Clinton Foundation. Rich individuals did meet with the Secretary of State in a fashion that they would otherwise not have been able to had they not donated vast amounts of money. And on and on and on. I mean, almost everything she said, Mr. Hanson writes here, about these current scandals is a lie. Now, with respect to the FBI investigation and Director Comey's statement there in July, at the end of July, this is after the investigation, this is after the statement, this is after the New York Times summarized Comey's statement, which I just read to you. This is what Hillary Clinton had to say on, I believe she was on Fox News on a Sunday morning talk show, July the 31st.
Director Comey said that my answers were truthful and what I've said is consistent with what I have told the American people. That there were decisions discussed and made to classify retroactively certain of the emails.
So even when the lies are exposed, she comes out and says, well, the guy who exposed all the lies said I was truthful. This is in the Washington Post, the fact-checker, Glenn Kessler. He said, Clinton is cherry-picking statements by Comey to preserve her narrative about the unusual setup of a private email server. This allows her to skate past the more disturbing findings of the FBI investigation. So she cherry-picked a statement here or there, even after the investigation concluded, to tell the American people that she was truthful, that she is honest, that she told the truth all the way through. Now, the Washington Post, following that exchange on Fox News, that July 31 interview, the Washington Post, I mean, two of the most liberal papers, New York Times, Washington Post, the Washington Post gave her four Pinocchios as to the level of deceit and dishonesty. That's the most that you can give for being dishonest in the view of the Washington Post. Now, again, these are just some of the more extreme examples, and yet these are the top leaders in American society. Going back to Victor Davis Hanson's piece, he says, everyone rightly catalogs Donald Trump's fibs, distortions, and exaggerations, his assertions about his net worth, his charitable contributions, his initial supposed opposition to the Iraq War, or his flexible positions on illegal immigration. After all, he is flamboyant, right-wing in his present incarnation, and supposedly bends the truth either out of crass narcissism or for petty profiteering. So the watchdog media and popular culture have no problem with ridiculing Trump as a fabricator, but not so with Hillary Clinton, whose untruths far outshadow Trump's in both import and frequency, but are so often contextualized, excused, and forgotten because of who she is and the purpose her outright lying supposedly serves. Now, we got into this even on Monday you know, with the New York Times coming out and really pointing out the level of deceit and dishonesty, the propaganda as it serves the Russian Federation, Vladimir Putin, and yet it has no problem with the fiction writers in the White House creating a false narrative, disseminating a false story in order to push the Iran nuke deal through. It serves a purpose, an agenda. Hansen says, lying in America has become not lying. When good liars advance alternative narratives for noble purposes, part of our long slide into situational ethics and moral relativism. See, if it's good lying, it's okay. If it creates an alternative narrative that squares with, in this case, the liberal agenda, and if it's for noble purposes, it's all right. Now, he doesn't spend as much time outside of that opening paragraph about Donald Trump's lies, but there's plenty on the other side that are quite willing to turn a blind eye to the level of dishonesty and deceit that you're coming from that side too. Hansen says, he kind of opens it up more broadly, giving us an excellent snapshot of our society. Every new bad idea in America today can ultimately be traced to the university. And it seems to take only about 30 years for academia's nihilism to filter through the elite institutions and make its way into popular culture. So it is with our present idea of truth as a mere construct. He says, in the 1980s and 90s, professors in the liberal arts became enamored with the French-speaking postmodern nihilists. He lists off a few of them there. He says they refashioned an old philosophical strain of relativism found as far back as the Greek sophists in Plato's discussion of the noble lie. It says they were influenced by Friedrich Nietzsche's attacks on absolute morality, and their youth was lived during the age of Joseph Goebbels and Pravda. Going back to education as the cause, it makes me think of what we cover in the first semester of Principles of Living at Armstrong College, relying on the textbook from Professor Bloom, Alan Bloom, The Closing of the American Mind. There's a chapter in there about nihilism, American style. He says a lot about moral relativism. This was a book written in the late 80s. I think it was 1987. On page 142 of his hardback version, Bloom says, intractable good and evil cause infinite distress, like war and sexual repression, which is almost instantly relieved when more flexible values are introduced. One need not feel bad or uncomfortable with oneself when just a little value adjustment is necessary. In other words, there's no longer absolute truth. There's no right or wrong. There's no good and evil. If you don't like something or you feel uncomfortable about something, just make a little value adjustment. Just tell a little white lie. A noble lie. And it's okay. Where did this start? Well, it got its start in Genesis and the Garden of Eden there, Genesis 2 and verse 8 to begin with. My pens are sliding all over the table here. Genesis 2. Let me just go through a couple of these verses. Genesis 2 and verse 8. So you have God planting a garden eastward in Eden. And then out of the ground, verse 9, made the eternal to grow every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food. The tree of life also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So two trees. And you can read in verses 16 and 17 of that same chapter, where God said, taking from the tree of life, I mean, that was good. That was consuming God's truth. God's knowledge, revelation from God. And then there was another tree, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and God said, don't eat of it. For in the day that you eat thereof, you shall surely die. Well, you know the story, I know. Genesis 3, verses 1 through 5. I'll just cut to the chase here. Looking at verse 5, it says, for God does know that in the day that you eat thereof, this is Satan talking to Eve, then your eyes shall be opened, and you shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. You don't need God's definition of what's right and wrong. You can decide for yourself. That's what Satan wanted them to do. Satan didn't come along and say, hey, bow down and worship me. I'm the devil. He is the god of this world. He is being worshipped. There's no doubt about that. But he's deceptive. He comes as an angel of light. He presents himself, as 2 Corinthians 11 says, as, well, what most people believe to be God. Satan, though, is a moral relativist. He makes value adjustments all the time. He's a liar. He's the father of lies. Alan Bloom says, in politics, in entertainment, in religion, everywhere we find the language connected with Nietzsche's value revolution, a language necessitated by the new perspective on the things of most concern to us, words such as charisma, lifestyle, commitment, identity, and many others, all of which can be easily traced to Nietzsche, are now practically American slang. Although they and the things to which they refer would have been incomprehensible to our fathers, not to speak of our founding fathers. He's talking about some dramatic changes that have taken shape just in the last few decades. Well, now, we're nearly 30 years on from when Bloom wrote that. And like Hansen brings out, every new bad idea in America can be ultimately traced to the university. Education is the problem. It's the cause. Now, let me take you to what Herbert Armstrong wrote in The Wonderful World Tomorrow. This was long before Bloom came along, or at least before he wrote his book. In 1987, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, I forget when the first version came out, certainly back in the 60s, perhaps the 50s. But Mr. Armstrong says here, the 19th and 20th centuries have witnessed the absorption of German rationalism into the educational bloodstream, an approach that regards human reason as the chief source and test of knowledge. There's been a dangerous drift into materialism and collectivism. God is ignored. Revelation is rejected. The ancient belief of Gnosticism, meaning we know, was succeeded by agnosticism, meaning we don't know. We're ignorant. And he says this ignorance is glorified as knowledge. Professing themselves to be wise, have not the educated become fools? Mr. Armstrong asks, paraphrasing the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians. He was way ahead of his time, for sure. You want to study on some deep thought on modern education, you can go back to the writings of Herbert Armstrong, Missing Dimension and Sex in particular, but there I just read to you The Wonderful World Tomorrow, Mystery of the Ages. Well, let me come back to this piece by Victor Davis Hanson, his latest column from just yesterday. And he's talking here about a similar theme as Professor Bloom brought out in 1987, this value revolution, and all of these new terms, charisma, lifestyle, commitment, and so on. Hanson says here, in fact, truth for a postmodernist is supposedly what those who control us say it is, largely in efforts to perpetuate their own race, class, and gender privilege. You can see how thoroughly popular culture has picked up this mostly banal relativist observation and transformed it into, quote, the truth, unquote. And why today we assume that lying is simply a narrative, not a window into one's character. See, that's the thing here, is lying, and Jesus, he got into this in Matthew 23. We'll get into it in a number of other passages. Lying is a window into one's character, like Hansen suggests it should be. But for most people, they just view it as, well, that's a narrative. It's a good story. I mean, it's for a noble cause. And then notice this paragraph. Very similar. It's just a little more updated. Very similar to what Alan Bloom said in 1987. Relativist slogans abound. One person's terrorist is another's freedom fighter. Hands up, don't shoot. Was never uttered by Michael Brown, who was not an innocent gentle giant, but a strong-armed robber who sought to take a policeman's gun and then charged at the cop. But since his fictitious last utterances should be true, therefore they are, and presto, became the slogan of Black Lives Matter. Those fictitious last words, well, they should be true. So it doesn't matter if the investigation reveals he never said it. He could have said it. He should have said it. That should have been the way it played out. In our minds, it did play out that way. In the opposite fashion, Hansen says here, there's to be no such thing as Black Lives Matter protesters calling for frying police or killing cops, since negation of the truth serves a far more noble purpose than would confirmation. So when they're out there saying those things, then the automatic knee-jerk response is that, well, no, they didn't say those things. Fry the police, kill the cops. He says here, Orwell was onto the game far earlier than the French postmodernists. He rightly saw it as a post-war pathway of the left to assuming and keeping power. What was written on the barn wall on Monday as an absolute commandment was crossed out and replaced on Tuesday in the fashion that the Soviet Union used to airbrush out sudden enemies of the people from all past pictorial records. Who knew that the party line would be? Who knew what the party line would be by Wednesday? Hansen says what frightened Orwell was not so much lying British industrialists or celebrities, but officers of the state who sought to dismiss the idea of the truth itself and justify the dismissal on ideological grounds. It is as if Orwell's story is now playing out. Orwell's fiction from the 1940s is now playing out. And then, well, I don't know if I'll take the time to read all of this, but Hansen lists off just a lot of things you probably will remember in the news. Gender is now defined not by biology, but by culture or suspect. Constructed norms, undocumented migrant replaces illegal alien. He says both Elizabeth Warren and Ward Churchill are Native Americans because they say they are. If Rachel Dolezal, I'm just hitting a few high spots here, and Sean King reconstruct themselves as Black Americans, then their stories are as legitimate as any others. When Hillary Clinton falls into her phony black patois to talk down to African-American audiences in an accidental caricature of a snooty suburbanite trying to seem cool or authentic, she's no more false than she was earlier in her Anne Oakley. Well, there's some references here that are a little obscure, at least to me, a little later. It says, we claim there's no such thing as truth, as assertions gain credulity only by the degree of wealth and influence behind them. White, male, Christian, heterosexuals usually are the boogeyman who establish self-interested standards of accuracy and fidelity. It says further, Barack Obama can make up narratives about underappreciated Islamic catalysts for the Western Renaissance or Enlightenment in his Cairo speech because such myth-making serves a noble cause of stopping Islamophobia. So we've got to put these myths out there. Early on in the presidency, this is June of 2009. Because, well, it serves the greater good. Obama himself can invent large chunks of his autobiography. And it's neither a lie nor a fable, given that his principled intent was to enlighten us about the burdens of growing up as the other. Well, he's admitted. Yeah, some of it's fiction. Most of it's true. And so how do you know? Well, it doesn't matter. It's the narrative that matters. Lying for Brian Williams, or plagiarism for Doris Kearns Goodwin, or Fareed Zakaria, can be passed off as the shoddy work of subordinates, or misremembering, or symptomatic of too full a schedule, not egotism, or laziness, or efforts at career enhancement. It says in 2012, the progressive future of the country hinged on the re-election of Barack Obama, so naturally ensuring that the imploding Middle East was quiet and that Al-Qaeda was somnolent demanded a truth that an obscure video maker and Islamophobic bigot had enraged otherwise peace-loving Muslims and incited them to burn down our consulate in Benghazi. An isolated act that had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. If that narrative meant that National Security Advisor Susan Rice had to lie 5 times on Sunday talk shows, or Hillary Clinton had to deceive the families of the Benghazi dead, or Barack Obama's Justice Department had to jail Nakula Basile on the trumped-up old probation charge, then the ends of an Obama re-election more than outweighed the unethical means of achieving it. The ends justified the means. Well, then he concludes with that paragraph about the email servers. The most recent scandals revolving around Mrs. Clinton. Hansen concludes here, the danger of democracy is never from the bad liars who patently fabricate for self, but from the sophisticated and progressive good liars who lie that their untruth is truth because it was all made up for us. You see, it's for our own good. That untruth, that lie, it's truth. Whether he said it or not, whether it happened or not, it doesn't matter. What matters is that this narrative, this false story, this lie, is for your own good. When we come back, we'll look at, as I said, assuming we have enough time, I'm looking at the clock and it's racing along, but we'll look at what God has to say about this dishonest and deceitful age that we're living in. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to email us, td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
A turning point in recent history has gone almost entirely overlooked. Since that time, an unseen cause has brought about national and world troubles in unprecedented fashion. Crises are intensifying as never before. In our generation, we are seeing radical changes to culture, family, education, religion, science, finance, politics, international relations. Everything has been affected. You cannot understand events without recognizing this unseen cause. The United States has been shaken in astonishing fashion. Have you wondered why the world's number one superpower is declining so rapidly? Are you concerned about where the current administration is leading this country? The Bible provides penetrating insight into the invisible cause of society's decline. America is prophesied to fall before it rises again. The Bible also gives extraordinary insight into how that fall will come about. This insight puts the seriousness and urgency of current events in their true perspective. Understand what's in store for America and why. Visit thetrumpet.com and click on the Literature tab to request this free, enlightening booklet, America Under Attack.
The Trumpet Daily.
So one passage we come to often on this program, Paul's epistle to Timothy, the second letter that he wrote to Timothy, where in chapter 3 it says that in the last days perilous times shall come. So it's an end time prophecy. This is for the last days, and then Paul describes the days that we're in, verse 3. It says there will be truce breakers and false accusers, which can also mean slanderers, but people who break their word. You can't trust them. You can't take them for their word. Down in verse 7, it says, ever learning and never able to come to a knowledge of the truth. So accumulating all of this information, but how do you know what's true? How do you know what's true and false? As I said earlier, many things in today's world, they're just not what they seem to be. Because there's lots and lots of lies being spread. Ever learning and never able to come to the truth. And then verse 13 says that evil men and seducers shall wax worse and worse, deceiving, it says, deceiving and being deceived. That spirit is everywhere. Now, if you know anything about the teachings of Herbert Armstrong and the way that God worked with him, the way that God prepared him for his calling, the way that God educated him. Well, Mr. Armstrong talked about it in one of his last messages in 1985. He said, I did not learn the doctrine I preach from men. And I'm about the only one in the church who can say that. All the rest in the church have learned it from me. I mean, God gave him a special education. He didn't go off to seminaries. He received the truth of God, direct from God's word, the Holy Bible, and that's what he preached. That's what he testified. He said later, brethren, so far as I know, no one else on earth except those who got it from us are observing God's annual Sabbaths. It just has not been done through the ages. This always stands out to me when I teach the Epistles of Paul class every other year here at the college. We got into it some this morning in class. Just the chronology, the dates, you know, the fact that Christ's crucifixion was in 31 A.D. Paul was converted to the truth about 4 years later or so. And you can go through the book of Acts as you move into the 40s and the 50s A.D. and the 60s, and you see references to these annual Sabbaths all throughout. Paul going, you know, hurrying back to Jerusalem so that he could keep the feast. And then writing to the brethren at Corinth about how to properly keep the Passover observance. You can see that in 1 Corinthians 11. 1 Corinthians 5 talks about the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Let us keep the feast, he said. This was a book written in the 50s A.D. Talk about truth as opposed to lies. 20 years on from Jesus Christ's death and crucifixion, his crucifixion and resurrection, 20 years on, 20 years into the New Testament church, you have evidence, all kinds of evidence, fact after fact after fact, of God's people, God's servants, observing these annual Sabbaths, keeping the weekly Sabbath, Hebrews 4. And so what does the world of traditional Christianity do today? Well, they don't keep these days, that's for sure. So far as I know, he said, no one else on earth except those who got it from us are observing God's annual Sabbaths. Are you receiving the truth? Are you receiving the truth from your church? If you're sitting in on a Sunday morning observance, a Sunday morning meeting, are you receiving the truth? Well, you ought to look into it. If you haven't already, you ought to. Look over in chapter 4, looking again more broadly at society in general. Well, really, this I think actually is aimed more at the world of religion in Timothy's day, as Paul gives him some profound instruction. Verse 2 of 2 Timothy 4, preach the word, be instant, in season, out of season, reprove, rebuke, exhort, with all long suffering and doctrine. Preach God's word, preach the truth. It says in verse 3, for the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but after their own lusts shall they heap to themselves teachers having itching ears. The time's coming when they're not going to endure sound doctrine. Even though it's sound, even though it's the truth, they're going to want a message of smooth things. They're not going to want the truth. It says in verse 4, and they shall turn away their ears from the truth and shall be turned unto fables. They're going to turn away from what the Bible says, and instead they're going to believe lies. That's what Paul told Timothy, and he had some experience in dealing with this. As I was saying in class this morning, I mean, he wrote to the people at Galatia, and he said, it's been 5 or 6 years, and you received the true gospel message from me. You received a testimony from me based on the word of God. And I'm shocked. I'm dumbfounded. I'm marveling at how soon removed you are from the truth. Look at how quickly it happened in our day. January of 1986, I mean, that was a high watermark for the Worldwide Church of God under the direction of Herbert Armstrong in every respect. TV coverage, plain truth circulation, congregations around the world, the number of ministers, the number of co-workers and donors, the annual income. And yet look at how fast it all fell apart. Mystery of the Ages was discontinued within 2 years of Mr. Armstrong's death. And it was just a few years after that entire church embraced the doctrine of the Trinity, which shuts man out of the God family. It destroys the God family vision. It destroys God's awesome purpose, which you read about in the very first chapter of Genesis. God making man in his own image and likeness. And then in John 1, you read about God and the Word, and how the Word came in the flesh, and how the Word was in the bosom of the Father, and how that Jesus Christ's purpose in coming in the flesh was to declare the Father of the family, the Father of the home. Well, they were so soon removed from that. by 1993, 1994, the law of God, the perfect and holy and just law of God, as Paul said in Romans 7. Well, the leaders of the Worldwide Church of God said at that time, 1994, that law had been nailed to the cross. And so we no longer needed to observe the laws of God. And then by 1996, we're only 10 years removed from Herbert Armstrong's death. A 50-some year ministry, decades of preaching the truth, millions upon millions of books and magazines and booklets, 6 million U.S. and Britain in prophecies, mailed worldwide. Well over a million Mystery of the Ages. Millions and millions more if you count the serialization of it in the plain truth. And 10 years on from his death, well, you had Joseph Dukach Jr. writing about the total and complete transformation of that church. And it happened within just a few short years. Had Mr. Armstrong been alive at the time of that writing, transformed by truth, he would have said something very similar to what Paul said in Galatians 1:6. I marvel that you're so soon removed from him that called you out of this world of deception and lies to the glorious truth of the true gospel message. They shall turn away their ears from the truth, it says, and shall be turned unto fables. They want lies instead of the truth. That's the problem. The prophet Isaiah, look at Isaiah 30. Very similar message here from one of the Old Testament prophets. Isaiah chapter 30 and verse 9. This too is an end time prophecy. You can see that elsewhere in the book. Isaiah 30 and verse 9, it says, this is a rebellious people, lying children, children that will not hear the law of the Eternal, which say unto the seers, see not, and to the prophets, prophesy not unto us right things, speak unto us smooth things, prophesy deceits. Here are the people of Israel. You can look at this physically and spiritually. Saying to God's servants, God's teachers, God's prophets, don't preach the right things. Speak smooth things. Prophesy deceits. That's what we want. That's what we want. We want the lies. We prefer the lies. Isaiah 59, I went through this chapter, I think a few months ago, at least it seems like a few months ago on the program. It may have been more recent than that. But look at what this chapter says about our society today. I mean, here Isaiah's writing about many of the very sins that are plaguing our nations today that you see making headlines every day. Verse 1 of Isaiah 59, behold, the Lord's hand is not shortened that it cannot save, neither his ear heavy that it cannot hear, but your iniquities, your sins have separated between you and your God, and your sins have hid his face from you, that he will not hear. And so what sins is he talking about? Well, he lists off quite a few. Verse 3, for your hands are defiled with blood and your fingers with iniquity, your lips have spoken lies. Your tongue has muttered perverseness. None calls for justice, nor any pleads for truth. They trust in vanity and speak lies. They conceive mischief and bring forth iniquity. This is God's assessment of our society today, our nations today. No one's pleading for the truth. It's all about vanity and lies. It's all about creating a good fictitious narrative. And if it's not altogether true in the facts, it doesn't matter. I think it was John Adams who said, facts are stubborn things. That was him back in the late 1700s. You couldn't very well say that today. Facts aren't stubborn. Just change them. Just make a value adjustment. And if this happened or that happened, I mean, how can we ever know for sure? All that matters is the narrative. And if someone comes out and lays it all out there after this thorough investigation saying, you lied here, you lied here, you lied here, you lied here, just look for one little statement that indicates or implies that, well, you didn't really mean it, and then latch onto that and say, he said I was truthful. He said I told the truth. And we move on. Well, the Washington Post might give you four Pinocchios, but still, you can move on from that. You might well become president of the United States. Down in verse 13, it says, in transgressing and lying against the eternal and departing away from our God, speaking oppression and revolt, conceiving and uttering from the heart words of falsehood. And judgment, it says, is turned away backward. Justice stands afar off. The truth, it says, is fallen in the street. The truth is fallen in the street. The truth is buried in the ground. It says over in Daniel 8, verse 15, yes, truth fails, and he that departs from evil makes himself a prey, and the eternal saw it, and it displeased him that there was no judgment. God saw all of this. Our nation's given to deceit, to falsehood, to lying. And he hates it. He hates it. Hosea 4 says he has a controversy with the inhabitants of the land because there's no truth. There's no truth. There's just swearing and lying. It says in the next verse, well, who's behind this? We're running out of time here, but John 8 and verse 44 speaks of Satan the devil, the father of lies. And you know the other verses we cite often. The influence of the devil in Ephesians 2, prince of the power of the air, and the fact that he's the god of this world, deceiving this world. Let me play for you. I think we have time to squeeze this in. This is a comment Mr. Armstrong made back in 1983.
So a civilization developed. And it was developed as Satan led humanity, as he had led Eve and Adam in the beginning. And it became Satan's world. Now, brethren, there's the thing that people do not realize, and I wonder if you people realize it. This is not God's world. God created the earth. God created man. God created all of the material that man has used to build his buildings, his cities, and all of the things of our civilization. But God didn't build it. Satan did. Satan is the one who inspired man, and man used what God gave him at the beginning with his one human spirit, which Satan, being a spirit, could influence. It became Satan's world. And because Adam accepted Satan's way, and the world has ever since, it has become Satan's world, and people have become the children of Satan.
This is not God's world. That's basically the premise on which Mystery of the Ages stands. That's what really moved Mr. Armstrong to write Mystery of the Ages, which has a lot to say about this present evil world, as Paul said in Galatians 1:4, and the coming new world. A world in which truth will flourish. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. God's truth in that soon coming new world. It's going to spread over all the earth. It sure is. It says here in one of the Proverbs, the lip of truth shall be established forever. God's ways will be established. There's prophecies, millennial prophecies in Isaiah 11 and elsewhere about truth. God's knowledge covering the earth. Like waters cover the ocean. That statement that I gave to you from John 8. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. I mean, that comes from the founder of true Christianity, Jesus Christ. And he said in John 4, a little earlier in the gospel, that there's coming a time when worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. That is coming. And I have a few other verses that we could go through as well that are so positive and hopeful. Perhaps we can save those for another time. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to email us, td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.